Boyd. Up next on Think, as universities across the country are trying to figure out how to safely bring faculty and students back to campus, one college president says schools are deluding themselves if they think they can return to anything like the old ways of doing things. We'll spend this hour with Michael Sorrell of Paul Quinn College, who worries many administrators are putting financial pressures and concerns about their reputations ahead of their responsibility for student and faculty welfare. We'll talk to Sorrell about how the pandemic will fundamentally change the college experience in America after a short break. Have put their ships out of commission for the same reason many correctional institutions have allowed inmates who are close to their parole dates to leave early. Both keep large numbers of people confined together for many hours each day, conditions that seem almost tailor-made for spreading a dangerous infectious disease like COVID-19. So how exactly will residential college campuses, where hundreds or thousands of people study, work, eat, and sleep in close proximity for months on end, be ready to safely welcome back students and staff to campus by August? At least one college president has a stark answer. They probably won't. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Michael J. Sorrell is president of Paul Quinn College, a small private school in Dallas. He is deeply concerned about the well-being of students, faculty, and staff. And while he understands the pressure administrators at other institutions face, he says they may be allowing their worries about money and reputation to cloud their judgments about how and when they can reopen their physical facilities. He wrote about this in a recent essay for The Atlantic titled Colleges Are Deluding Themselves, and he joins us to talk about what's on his mind. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Hey, Chris. It's great to be here.
You call COVID-19 the direst crisis college presidents have ever faced, and you run a college that was very close to closing before you took over as leader. What makes this harder than anything else you or your peers around the country have faced?
Well, I think there are several things that make it more difficult. Number one, it's something that no matter how hard you try, you cannot control. Hmm. It's a global pandemic. So the reality of it is it's not just the most difficult crisis that colleges and college administrations have faced. It's the most difficult challenge that any of us as collectively as a body have faced. And, for society have faced. I mean, it's destroyed our economy. It's challenged every social norm that we have. It's forced us to rethink even the most simplest of acts. We don't even feel good anymore about shaking hands or giving hugs. Mm. So this is something none of us have ever seen. And my point in much of what I have been advocating is stop pretending that it isn't. Mm. Let's acknowledge what we're facing with and that we don't have all the answers and try to get this right in a way that is cautious and in the long-term best interest of our students.
So you're thinking about your moral responsibility to students and faculty and staff. How do you balance that moral responsibility with what may be competing interests like, fiscal responsibility and the reputation of the school, that sort of thing?
Sure. I mean, there are always competing interests. And maybe this is just too much of the Jesuit training that I got when I was in high school, right? But I subscribe to the common good. And the common good places a certain ethical responsibility on your shoulders as a leader. And the first step of being a leader in any circumstances is that the care and safety of the people that you are responsible for. And I have listened to my peers talk about the financial strength of their institutions or that some of their students come from difficult places and that this is the safest place for them. And look, I assume there's a way you can convince yourself of those things. But here's what I come to understand about having dealt with significant financial challenges is that you face them head on. Right? Like you look at your model and you say, what can I do to succeed in these circumstances, right? So when we sat down to try and chart a financial path forward, we started from the acknowledgement that this is something that we cannot control. What colleges and universities, residential colleges and universities are, happens to be the perfect breeding ground for the spread of this virus. We have no real idea all of the behavioral characteristics of the virus because it's so new. So jumping back in to an environment where you already know you are ideal for spreading a disease that is, you know, causing long-term health consequences to people. Because here's the other thing. We don't even know what the disease does yet. What does it mean to survive COVID-19? Does it mean that it's as if you're surviving the flu? Or do we know how long the after effects will be with people? We already know that it is killing people, that it's causing, you know, impact, attacks your organs differently. So we honestly don't know what it does. So our answer to not knowing what it does is to say, well, we've got to go back as close to business as usual as possible. Instead of saying, we don't know what it does, we cannot be sure that we can keep our students safe. So why don't we explore a different financial model? Why don't we go back and look at how do we restructure debt? How do we restructure contracts? How do we behave in a manner that lives up to a higher moral degree or a higher moral standard than that which we may be comfortable with initially? The trade-off, you know, I had this long conversation with some folks over Twitter about cost-benefit analysis. And the point that I was trying to make is you can't do cost-benefit analysis accurately if you can't ascertain what the true costs are. And we don't know what the true costs are at this moment. That's the problem with trying to reason with a global pandemic.
So
you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. When I was in college, I worked at a movie theater, and I was really surprised to learn that, like, the real profits, at least at that time in that theater, came from concession sales rather than tickets. I realize that different colleges and universities will have different circumstances, different endowments, tuition revenues. Can you give us a sense, though, of the biggest costs and also the biggest income streams that tend to figure into college budgets?
Well, I mean, truthfully, it just depends what your college is, mm-hmm. right? I mean, every college is financial model is a little bit different, right? Well, here's what we do know. We do know that student tuition revenue, or we'll call it student revenue, right? Because it's more than tuition, but people say tuition, and there are lots of other fees and things caught that go into it. So student revenue is always significant. Fundraising is always significant. Some institutions, the endowment is more significant than others. You have auxiliary income, which could be catering, which could be events, renting out the facilities, things of that nature. So you have a myriad of revenue sources. But what many colleges have done is they've over-leveraged themselves. So they've spent a lot of money with this expectation of money that was going to come in, and they've done so in a way that has left them vulnerable. And I get that model, right? When I arrived at Paul Quinn, we were an institution like that. We had a financial model that, quite frankly, didn't work. It left us vulnerable in all types of unattractive ways. And what we've done is we've unraveled from that model. We said, how do we create a financial picture that allows us to be nimble, that allows us to withstand cyclical shocks? Now, this is a cyclical shock that, quite frankly, we never would have expected or predicted. But what it's done is it's allowed us to be able to take a step back and say, okay, how do we live up to our moral standard? And our moral standard is we will always act in the best interest of our students and our staff. And the best interest of our students and staff is keeping them home right now, is putting them in a place that doesn't increase their amount of personal interaction. And now we can't we can't control what it is you choose to do at home. We can talk to you about it. We can advise you. But what we can do is not replicate a model where you are most at risk, putting you in a dorm where 200-300 other people are going to come into contact with you every single day, right? Every single day. We're not going to put you in a cafeteria where you're going to come into contact with, you know, another 400-500 people every single day, 2-3 times a day. We're not going to put you in party scenarios where you're going to come into contact with 1,000 people. We're going to manage what we can manage here. And so to do that, how do we tweak our model? And we said, well, let's look at it from this perspective. Number one, maybe the buildings that we are building, because we have the first new buildings in 40 years, will be finished this month and next month, right? So we have debt service that's owed on those. But you know what? We aren't the only institution that's going to need some restructuring of the debt. Okay, I mean, it is a global pandemic. Lots of people are in this way. Turns out that our partners on this completely understood it, and we're willing to restructure some debt. Then we looked around and we said, okay, how then do we manage the student enrollment issue? And we looked around and said, you know what? No matter what we want to believe, we can't assure our incoming students that they're going to have an experience that is what we represent. So why don't we reduce the size of the incoming class and create an environment where we can, the ones we have in these special categories, we can begin to give them something closer to the type of experience and attention that we normally do. We also looked around and said, well, what other costs can we cut? Well, let's change the way we maintain the campus. If we don't have students here, then there's some costs that we can cut. And then we went back and said, well, you know, people are really concerned about online learning. Well, for us, it wasn't that big of a transition because we use a hybrid instruction model. So our students were accustomed to taking 50% or so of their courses, of their class time online, right? Because that allowed us to manage the work program more efficiently and effectively. So then we also have gone out and partnered with Minerva, highly innovative and incredible institution out of San Francisco, which is remaking an Ivy League model for an online platform and students all over the world. So we've now partnered with them, and we're going to use their online platform, which is radically different than anything else in the marketplace. And we're beta testing it with Minerva to see how effectively this model works for students from under-resourced communities. So we've looked at this, we've planned for it, we've scaled down because we said we don't want anyone to be sick on our watch. And we just think it's the right thing to do. And if you plan for it, you can reduce the risk of economic Armageddon. Now, it doesn't mean that something can't happen. It doesn't mean that we may not look up and, you know, have to make some other modifications. But here today, let me tell you what we haven't had to do. We haven't had to reduce faculty. We haven't had to cut, salaries. And yes, it's June. And hopefully those things don't come. But as I look at the landscape of institutions so much more supposedly well-resourced than us who have had to do those things, we look at our responsibilities a little bit different.
My guest is Michael J. Sorrell. He's president of Paul Quinn College. We're talking about the challenges for colleges and universities trying to educate students during the COVID-19 pandemic.
And I go to Stephen F. Austin State University. I personally do feel safe going back to my college campus back in the fall, and they're starting to become a little less strict on the restrictions, which I think is a step in the right direction. I mean, they wouldn't be like allowing us to do this if it wasn't safe.
Hello. So my name is Sheldon Bielma. I'm currently attending the University of North Texas. I feel like if we're not going to be able to get everything that's supposed to be offered to us that we're paying, you know, $15,000 for at minimum a semester, we definitely need some sort of compensation for all the things that we're going to be missing out on.
My name is Peace Matweri. I go to Northwestern University and I'm going to be a senior in the fall. I really want to go back to school. And I think, yes, college is about academics, but it's about so much more than that. Like, there's school and homework and projects. Like, it's about interacting with other people and even having relationships and friendships.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was a montage of students eager to go back to school. We're speaking this hour with Paul Quinn College President Michael J. Sorrell. We're talking about the challenges for colleges and universities trying to educate students during a pandemic. Sorrell worries it isn't safe to bring students back on campus in most situations. So, Michael, we should note that many college students in this country never actually have the sort of classic experience we see in the movies. They don't necessarily live on campus or even away from home. But for some students who enter college straight out of high school, it is kind of a valuable bridge to adult independence to live on campus. I recognize that when you've got a hole in the side of the boat, you're not too busy polishing the steering wheel. But is there anything schools can do to facilitate this kind of growth if they can't invite students back physically?
Well, absolutely, Chris. I mean, and I would frame it this way. I think, you know, everyone talks about the college experience without really, really acknowledging that for most students, there is no one type of college experience. And I'll give you an example. So I was a college basketball player. My college experience was not the same as someone who was, and I was at Oberlin, someone who was in the conservatory. My college experience wasn't the same as someone who lived nearby in one of the towns near the campus and went home every weekend. I mean, we all experience college in a slightly different way. And we put enormous value in the in-person experience because, listen, I think it's wonderful. I'm a fan of it. I think everyone should have the opportunity to experience living on campus, but not everyone does. And so what this, you know, what we're being asked to believe is that some of what is supposed to be the smartest people in our society cannot figure out how to bridge this gap. And I find that a little bit hard to believe. I think maybe the better answer for it is maybe some of these people just aren't motivated to bridge the gap, because it will take work. It will require something different, but it also requires, excuse me, telling your students and telling their parents, this isn't going to last forever, but this is how it's going to be for now. And by the way, we're going to do it this way because we think this is the safest way to proceed. And, you know, my mother and father once told me, and that actually wasn't just once, they repeatedly told me that everything that was good to you wasn't good for you. And I always tried to remember that. Now, they certainly weren't talking about global pandemics and living on a college campus, but their point, I think, is applicable here, that, yes, we want to have this experience, but I want for a moment for all of us who are involved in colleges just to honestly assess the circumstances. I mean, let me ask you, where did you go to college?
TCU, Fort Worth.
All right. So if memory serves me correctly from when I was a much younger man when I moved here, TCU had a pretty solid social component Thursday through Sunday, right?
Yes.
Okay. So let's just imagine hypothetically that, you know, you are at TCU, and let's say you're a freshman, and it's rush season. And so you go to all the various sororities to try and figure out which sorority is right for you. And so you do that one weekend. Let's say one weekend you go to four different sororities to take a look at them. And then there's a football game. And you go to the football game. And then there's just you know, random night out with your friends, okay? So you have all of that, and you have all of that, and one of the places you go to, there are people there who are asymptomatic. And people have taken precautions, but it's not foolproof. And so now you yourself become someone who spreads this. Not because you wanted to, not because, but because you, you know, and they were practicing, right? Like, I mean, so when you went to class, the size of the lecture halls were reduced. You were worried, so you didn't go to the campus, you know, gym or fitness center, so you just ran outside instead. You were diligent about, you know, wearing your mask, but it's hard to wear the mask and go drinking with your friends and to have a social life. That's every college campus in America just about. Mm. So how exactly are you going to regulate the students' social behaviors without inciting a riot? Which, by the way, right now, everyone is hypersensitive to anyway.
Yeah.
Right? So here we are. So here we are trying to figure this out. And I mean, like, that's not an unreasonable scenario. And let me say this, too, just being completely transparent. We had a scenario, you know, we're working on our building, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've got first new buildings are being, you know, constructed. And one of the members on the crew was tested positive for COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And so the amount of stress associated with someone on the construction team, not a student, okay, but someone who, but when you're on our campus, we care about you, we love you, we want to take care of you, we want to make sure you're okay. Just the amount of stress that happened, and thankfully, you know, his seems to be a very isolated case. The stress level associated with that was extraordinary. I can't imagine what it's going to be like every single day for an entire school year.
So
every single weekend.
Yeah, I want to talk about financial stress as well. So I have three of my children are enrolled at three different universities in the fall, which is why I wear cheap shoes. You know, a lot of students in America right now are going to find it harder than ever to pay for school if either they or someone in their families have experienced a job loss. Will the economy have a major effect on enrollment for the next few years? And are you worried about students who say, I'm just going to sit out 2020 school year and spring 2021 and go back in the fall of 2021? Are you worried those students will have a harder time actually returning to school?
Well, I mean, let me say this. I am president of a small college. I worry about enrollment every day.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had the luxury of being on cruise control when it came to enrollment. So maybe part of my comfort for this is that it's all I've ever known. You know, we haven't had those same concerns that other people are just now awakening to. So I think you do have to worry about it. Absolutely. But I think you think realistically you should have been worried about it all along, because if you look at the demographic trends. Now, I don't necessarily so much worry about whether or not people will come back, because I think they will come back. But here's something that I do find interesting. Why do we behave as if we think we shouldn't have to compete? Right? I mean, we have to compete for students. So this is an opportunity for people to become better. Because I will tell you this, when people return to the on-campus experience at Paul Quinn, they will be coming back to something radically different than what they left. Because we are taking this time to throw ourselves into improving ourselves.
So what is that going to look like?
So in addition to new buildings, we will have new academic programs. We will have an honors college. We are negotiating right now to add a charter school to the campus. We've talked about the partnership with Minerva. In the short term, I mean, this won't affect them, but, you know, we're going to open up a COVID-19 testing site on the campus where we're doing food drives and things of that nature. We're going to revamp our admissions program. We're going to open up a satellite site of the college. We're revamping the curriculum some more. We're going to have a new website. I mean, for us, we've taken the approach, this is literally how we approach this. We said, how do we come through this better than when we entered it?
Before,
so we have spent zero time saying, woe is me, and greeted this as an opportunity to become better.
Before we go to the phones, Michael, we had a caller ask, what is Minerva? And I should have asked you to explain that earlier.
Sure. So Minerva is this fascinating college out of San Francisco. So it's called the Minerva Project. And they set out to create a new Ivy League institution that did not subscribe to the Ivy League residential model. They have students coming from all over the world. It's one of the most difficult schools to get into. It's one of the most rigorous academic environments. They pioneered this online platform where instead of sitting in front of your screen for long periods of time, you actually are engaging with each other continuously. I've done the beta test, you know, and I was somebody that really liked to sit in the back of the classroom so I could kind of space out. You can't space out. You are constantly being forced to engage. You have little chat rooms. And then you have, you know, you go to school. They create a housing environment, right? So your classes are online, but you've got a wonderful residential component that's different. You're not in a dorm. You're in a house or you're in an apartment, and you have group projects that will allow you to engage with each other offline. I mean, they're extraordinary, right? They are absolutely extraordinary. And the CEO and I have become really good friends, Ben Nelson. We both happen to be University of Pennsylvania graduates, me for my doctorate, Ben for undergrad. And, we've always talked about, is there a way to do what they do and use it in a broader scale to speak to students who would not have the economic or perhaps even the academic preparation at the moment of their typical education to make use of their platform? And we found a way to do that. So we are beta testing that, you know, this year.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. We have Matt calling us from Plano, Texas. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Chris.
Hey.
Thanks for the conversation. Dr. Sorrell, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I've been a big fan of what you did at Paul Quinn College, rescuing it out of bankruptcy. The work that you did, with internships. I know with the mayor of Plano, you've done work internships there. But my question is, I went to UT Dallas, had a great on-campus experience, and that was still considered a commuter college. How are, if more colleges take the view that you do, which is reasonable, keeping students away from campus, I worry that, online colleges are going to pop up. A few years ago, there was a lot of fraud with for-profit universities, one called Corinthian College, who made all sorts of promises about what students would get.
Well, thank you for calling, Matt. Yeah, are you worried, Michael, that there will be competition from for-profit schools that may not be as concerned with the overall welfare of their students as not-for-profit schools?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, there are residential colleges that are not-for-profit that I don't think are as concerned with their students, right? So, the short answer is no. I'm not concerned about that for this reason. I think consumers have become far more savvy. And what I'm advocating is not a wholesale embrace of all things online and returning to the wild, wild days where everyone was approved and things like that. What I'm saying is we are at our core a residential college. We're going to remain a residential college. But part of being a residential college, part of our culture, is our absolute commitment to putting the needs of our students and the health and well-being of our students first. So for this period of time, we have to shift to this. But, you know, if we want students to come back to the residential environment, then we should invite them back to a residential environment that's going to be improved and better than the one they left. I mean, I just don't understand why, you know, in a society where capitalism is our chosen economic system, which is based off of competition, that we pick and choose which industries should have to compete. I think, you know, Matt, I love UT Dallas. I'm a Comet fan. I think they do amazing work there. But I would never worry about UT Dallas not being able to compete against anyone, let alone a for-profit online institution.
My guest is Michael J. Sorrell. He's president of Paul Quinn College. We're talking about the challenges for colleges and universities trying to educate students during the COVID-19 pandemic.
My name is Cal Jolson. I'm professor of political science at SMU, and I teach a course on Texas politics. I think that there's really no way online to have an experience as varied and rich as you get in the classroom. That is the most comfortable, familiar experience for both teachers and students. And you do the very best you can online to deliver the same content, but you don't have the eye contact in quite the same way.
My name is Jacqueline Fellows. I'm a journalism professor at SMU in Dallas. When we ask the question, should tuition be reduced because students are not on campus? The immediate, the knee-jerk response is, yes, they're not using buildings. But then that asks a larger question. Well, then what is college? Well, college is definitely, and university education is definitely more than a building, right? It's not just about being on campus. It's about the information that goes, you know, into your brain.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paul Quinn College President Michael J. Sorrell. We're talking about the challenges for institutions of higher learning trying to educate students during the COVID-19 pandemic. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372. Michael, what conversations have you had with fellow administrators and with members of your board of trustees about tuition rates and whether they need to change if you are all online for the time being?
Well, we decided that we were going to cut the cost of attendance by $4,000. So if we wind up being online next year, then we'll go from charging the total cost of attendance being $16,500 to charging just about $12,000. So I think that's right. I mean, I don't know why you would charge people the same exact thing for a radically different product. Now, I do think, you know, people have to learn that, you know, I said this earlier, that we typically think of tuition as everything associated with attending a school. And so I don't think you should cut tuition because I think there's still a tremendous amount of work and sophistication that goes into delivering the academic material. But I think there are other costs that you can reduce so that people's total budget hit has been reduced. And we feel very strongly about that. So our board was completely supportive of it. Our faculty and staff have been completely supportive of it.
To Cal Jolson's point at the top of the segment, I would imagine there are professors who take instantly to how online education works and others who feel like there is no replacement for in-person contact. What are you doing with instructors who may be less comfortable with the idea of doing things in this new way?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. People generally struggle with change. Right? I mean, they do. And so some of the concerns come from understanding that for some people, change is scary. And what the culture we tried to create at Paul Quinn is one where we tell people no problem is ever permanently solved. So we want them to become comfortable with this idea of persistent and constant evolution, which is change. We're constantly looking for ways to improve. So, you know, my faculty has been unbelievable. They haven't greeted this from a fearful standpoint, right? Like, they didn't treat it as if they were engaged in a scarcity mindset. They instead said, you know what? This is what's required. Let's go figure out how to be great at this. And, you know, we reevaluate our performance at each step of the way. And that, I mean, that's what I think you're supposed to do. So I acknowledge that for some folks, this is going to be tough and it's going to be scary. But that is not an excuse for not doing it. I hope that he belongs to an institution that works with those individuals who are less comfortable to help them become more comfortable and more effective. I mean, that's the best anyone can hope for.
All right, let's go back to the phones. The number is 800-933-5372. Avery is calling from Denton, Texas. Hi, Avery.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I had a question. During the week, I work construction, and then on the weekend, I'm a licensed healthcare provider. So online classes are a very, very useful tool for me. I've noticed this trend at my institution and at a lot of other colleges and universities where they're really hesitant to promote online classes. I was wondering if you could have any insight on that.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. Thank you for your question. Let me say this. Thank you for your service. I mean, you effectively are working two jobs and going to school, and that is an enormous commitment and an enormous sacrifice, right? So I just want to say thank you for your hard work. And to your question, I think people don't promote it because at the end of the day, really, for let's just say two reasons. We'll take the noble and the less noble. The noble reason is they believe very strongly that going to school in person provides a superior experience. And when you believe that, then, you know, you're going to promote that which you feel very strongly about. The less noble reason is because they can charge you more if you go to school in person than they do if you go to school online, and it becomes a profit source. So hopefully you attend an institution where there is nobility and they are looking at this from the standpoint where they just fundamentally believe in the on-campus experience or the in-person experience and not someone that is looking at you as just another way to make the ends meet.
So of all the risks you took, Michael, when Paul Quinn College was staring down the barrel of bankruptcy and possibly even closure when you started, was getting rid of sports the biggest risk?
You know, it's interesting. We didn't get rid of all the sports, right? We got rid of football and we got rid of baseball. But we made it, I would say it this way, Chris. Our biggest risk was deciding that we were going to articulate a set of values and then completely dedicate ourselves to living up to those values. Because, so here's why that comes into context with sports. We terminated programs where we could not play the same sport for the men and women on the same or in the same facility. Because we thought that it sent a very, very bad message to our young ladies about how we saw them. So, for example, you know, Title IX dictates that for every dollar you spend on a men's sport, you have to spend on a women's sport. So for a lot of colleges out here, football has created a growth industry in women's athletics. Schools would have never invested in women's athletics if they weren't trying to justify being able to play football. Well, we think there's a psychological cost to that, right? And so we decided, well, look, how about we use the venues that every sport can use? So basketball, we have a gym. men's basketball, women's basketball, and women's volleyball all use the same gym. Then we have soccer. Men's and women's soccer use the same soccer field. Track, you know, we don't have a on-campus track facility, but, you know, we've got people who run the same rows. They run the same path. You know, it was about living up to our culture. So the risk was that you would embrace a culture that everyone wouldn't see value in. And the other risk that we have is we are committed to being advocates for the people we serve. Even if it means it costs us a little more money, we just think that's the right thing to do.
Well, where I wanted to lead with this question was, you know, a lot of schools that are looking at coming back are also looking at very quickly resuming their athletic programs. And I don't know about the extent to which that is just about keeping folks in condition or about the extent to which that is ultimately about the revenue that, you know, big college sports can bring into certain schools.
Yeah, so I think it's revenue. I think that it is, I think it's just what we like, right? I mean, so let's think about this from this perspective. What COVID-19 is exposing about Americans and American culture is we do not like to sacrifice what we want for an extended period of time. Because we reopened knowing that it's not safe to do all the things that we've gone back to do. I mean, we know that. But this is because, some of this is because of the economy, absolutely. But there was a different way of approaching this to just, you know, help to revitalize the economy. A lot of this was just because people were tired of being told that they had to make sacrifices. They were tired of being home. They were tired of not being able to go out. They were tired of not doing those things. And we didn't have the political will to continue to do that. And we're going to have lots more people being sick as a result and dying as a result of that. I mean, look at the number of cases that are rising locally. So I don't know how you play football and keep people safe. That just doesn't seem reasonable. I'm sure people are going to do it, and I'm sure there'll be a bunch of people who are pretty safe. But if we knew what the end result of having it, COVID-19 was, then I would feel a little bit better. I mean, like, if you told me, well, here's what's going to happen. Maybe 1% of the population is going to get this, and getting it means that they are, you know, they're out of commission for a couple of weeks, but there's no long-term side effects. That's something different, but we just don't know that. We just don't know that.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What metrics will you use to decide when the time is right to bring most students, faculty, and staff back on campus if they want to be there?
Sure. I mean, one, there will absolutely have to be a better national testing regimen than the one that we have right now. I think, you know, we should test everyone. And that would allow us to be able to get a handle on this much better. I think that, you know, certainly a better testing protocol if there's a vaccine. But we don't feel the rush to bring people back right now to be guinea pigs. We think we have the luxury of time. You know, my daughter goes to a great school where the administrators often talk about giving your child the gift of time. We are giving our students the gift of time. You know, we want to be able to figure this out. We want to be able to speak from a place of knowledge. And we can't do that right now. And I think that's troublesome.
Paul Quinn College is a historically black college. We know that in this country, black Americans face higher rates of illness with COVID-19 than the broader population and higher death rates when they do get sick. How much has that additionally played into the kinds of decisions you're making as an administrator? Would your decision-making be the same if your school's population racially and ethnically matched pretty closely with the broader U.S. population?
my decision would still be the same, because we still don't know, right? And I have non-black students, and I don't look at them any less. And I'm not saying that you insinuated that I did. I'm saying that I still feel the same heightened sense of responsibility. And as I look at this, I mean, now the racial component is troublesome. And it absolutely is something that we pay attention to, but we still don't have enough information. Maybe if we had more information and there was still this discrepancy, then I would still have to take this approach because of our student body. But here and now, the issue is still that we just don't know enough.
Do you miss seeing your students on campus?
Every day. Every day. Like, I love my students. I mean, they're the best part of this job. And they are, you know, I am constantly in touch with them on social media, text messages, phone calls, FaceTime, Instagram. And my son's back here, like, Instagram. I love them. And we love them. And we miss them. But, again, you know, we want to do right by them.
Michael J. Sorrell is president of Paul Quinn College. His recent essay for The Atlantic was titled "Colleges Are Deluding Themselves." Michael, it's always great to speak with you. Thanks very much for making time for us today.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. And I continue to be an enormous fan of your work. And good luck with your decision around the three of your kids going back to school.
I appreciate it. Thank you. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. You can subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get your podcast. Just do a search for KERAThink. You can listen to the podcast on our website as well. A full archive of shows is available there at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.